Good morning, Arizona. Thank you for joining us today. I want everybody to know that we're taking the social distancing very serious here. John is in a completely different room, and we're the only two people in the studio. Before I introduce our guests, I want to remind everybody that we are hosting a GoFundMe account for the K-9 unit for Tucson Police Department. They ran into some hard times regarding one dog and some of the medical bills, and the cost of medicine actually took over their equipment fund. So we're trying to get them some funds. If you go to lawmatters1030.org, go to the logo in the left corner and click on it, and the GoFundMe page will pop up. We really need your help. So on the phone today, all the way from Washington, D.C., is former Congressman Jim Colby. Congressman, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Sherry. We definitely are practicing social distancing at 2,000 miles here.
There
you go. I was supposed to be in the studio with you, but unfortunately, here I am in Washington right now.
How are you feeling? You're healthy? Everything's good?
I'm feeling very healthy, but staying indoors for the most part, just venturing out when I need to get to the grocery store. But that's about it.
There you go. You know, a couple of months ago when the trial was taking place, I was watching the news. I was watching all the chaos and the rhetoric that was flying back and forth. And I think I told you this. I literally outside, out loud said, you know, where's Jim Colby when you need him? When I think of you, I think one of the good guys, somebody who's got integrity, you're hardworking, you represented everybody in Arizona, not just a few.
Well, you're very kind, but that's what happens with the passage of time. You forget all the things you did, may not have liked about me there.
No, I voted for you every time, too, and I'm an independent, so.
Thank you.
I found you at the National Institute of Civil Discourse, and why am I not surprised? Can you tell our listeners how it started and what you do there?
Sure. The National Institute for Civil Discourse came about as in the aftermath of the tragic Gabby Gifford shooting. And the idea was to create some kind of a national discourse where we could, instead of having these violent, extreme things happen, where people could have a conversation and talk to each other, and the politicians and voters and politicians and those in public life could have this kind of a conversation. The idea is to return to civil discourse instead of the shouting that seems to characterize so much of the conversation we have in the world today, and certainly in our political discourse. So that's the idea of it. And we have a lot of different programs where we encourage young people to get involved, or we do town halls and meetings and call-ins. And it's a really good program. It's based there in Arizona, but it's become a national organization with an office back here in Washington. When I say based in Arizona, it was founded, I guess I should say there. The executive director is back here in Washington now.
It was affiliated with the U of A, wasn't it? Or isn't it?
It was. Its start was there at the University of Arizona, but as I say, it's gone beyond that now, and it still has a strong affiliation there in Tucson. But it's a nationwide program, and our current executive director is somebody that comes from Idaho and was very active in the political realm up there, of being involved in trying to establish a conversation, a discourse between people in the world and living out in the countryside or in the community, I should say, and those who were in holding public office. And that's the idea of it. And we try to create a better discourse where we can have a conversation instead of a shouting match.
You know, I experienced that here on the show a couple of weeks ago. Well, I invited some guests on, and one guest totally disagreed with another guest's viewpoint, and during the commercial, literally, verbally assaulted him to the point where I had to tell him, stop what you're doing.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. We don't need that, and we should be able to listen to what other people are saying and to hear them. We don't have to agree with them. We can hear their point of view and try to understand where they're coming from and why they have the point of view that they do. And I think that's so much more useful than just simply pulling down a barrier and saying, you're wrong, I'm right, you're wrong, and I'm not going to agree with you, and I'm going to shout at you when you start to tell me what you think. So it's just better to have a conversation about these things and so we can listen to each other.
How do you feel about the tension. It's tension. I feel tension in today's political arena.
Well, it's certainly very strong. Tension is, when you use the word tension, I would say very strong. I can't remember in my experience in public life where we've had as much polarization. I use that word advisedly, polarization of political thinking, where people are just completely on one side or the other. You see it reflected over and over in national polls, even in something like the coronavirus that we're experiencing right now with this health crisis. The number of people that who are Trump supporters who believe it's either not true or is a hoax or is being over exaggerated, and those on the end think that the president has been handling this well, and those on the other side who think exactly the opposite about this, who happen to be Democrats or opposed to President Trump and have exactly the opposite thing. You know, we ought to be able to listen to both sides here and just get what is the real answer in the middle, which is how we deal with this. We are in a health crisis, and how do we deal with this? But unfortunately, there's just this so much political polarization. I think there's a lot of reasons for that, and certainly one of the major reasons that I think we experience today is social media, which is just become a platform for people to take positions and shout from the rooftop, but not listen to what anybody else is saying. You can't have a really serious discourse, a really serious conversation in 140 characters. You have to have a more in-depth conversation. That's what we're not getting today. We're not getting that kind of conversation.
No, that's so true. And I just think it's so reckless to be on a public stage, you know, saying that we've got a cure and, you know, this vaccine will be available to everybody when it, you know, people, it's not
clearly
true.
It's not. We don't have a vaccine. We're not yet close to any kind of a vaccine. There are some promising things that are being done, as what I've been hearing and reading about treatments of things that can help people get better fast when they do get the COVID-19 virus. But as far as a vaccine, we're probably at least a year away. They're already beginning some tests, but they'll have to be very large-scale tests, and then it has to be approved, and then it has to be manufactured. And we're probably not talking about anything until next spring, most likely. I mean, it'd be wonderful if we get it a little faster than that, but we're going to be going through several months for sure without this. Now, you know, there's this idea that Dr. Fauci has talked about and others that there may be a lapse or a lag, I should say, in the middle of the summer here when it's warmer, and then it will come back again in the fall. So we shouldn't have any false view that it's going away if the numbers go down this summer. That's still around and still here and still lurking and could likely come back.
I heard that it's going to go away when it gets hotter, and when it's colder it comes back. Doesn't compute in my head.
It doesn't really compute, does it? I'm no doctor, so I'm not an epidemiologist, so I certainly don't have the expertise for that. And Dr. Fauci has said this may be a false idea anyhow, because you have places like Indonesia and Taiwan and other places, or Singapore rather, in Vietnam, where there are tropical climates, and this has been very warm. And we have the virus there. So it's not anything sure that it's, but the theory is just like the regular flu, is that when it's warmer, you're less likely to get this kind of a respiratory infection. So that may be the case, but we just don't know. We certainly can't bank on that.
Okay. I know it's a little early than 12 minutes, but I think we should take a break here and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is former Congressman Jim Colby. If you have any questions, call 790-2040. And I want to ask, what is your position at the National Institute of Civil Discourse? What do you do?
I'm on their board of advisors. I'm not don't have any official position at all, but I've been helping them out. They asked me to serve when it was getting started, and I said, sure, of course. I really believe in this, and I was, of course, knew Gabby well, and I thought this was a good thing for us to do. I have been very concerned, even before I left Congress, with the decline in the conversation that we're having in this country, and in the political realm. I could see it in Congress that there was people less willing to associate with the other side, to talk to each other, to work across the aisle, and I think that's disturbing, because I think the American people want us to find solutions, and they don't think there's just one side that has the right solution to the problems that we face, and there just has to be more of a willingness to work across the aisle in this, and that's what's been declining, and we see it throughout our society. It's not just the political realm. We see it when we see it on the ball field. We see it in our classrooms. We see it on the streets. We see it everywhere. There's just a lack of civil discourse, I think, and I just think that that's something we need to be working on. So that's why I got involved with it.
No, I think that's commendable, and I really, and I've said it a bazillion times, and that's a modest estimate. If people would just sit down and have a conversation, break bread, talk about what you agree on, and then work on what, you know, your differences are. Why do you feel that way? This is why I feel this way. You know, it's just, it makes sense.
We have several similar organizations and things underway with dealing with former members of Congress. And current members of Congress that are trying to bridge this and get Democrats and Republicans working together, talking together. So it's not just from the National Institute of Civil Discourse, but there's these other programs that are out there that have been started mostly by former members of Congress, but working to go within their colleagues, their former colleagues in Congress, to try to get this conversation going again. And I'm hopeful. I really am. I think the American people are basically good people, and I think that we have a way to make this work. I think we can make it work.
Yeah, you just have to be willing to open your ears instead of your mouth.
Absolutely. That's so true.
So you were a congressman for quite a while. Who was your favorite president to work under?
Well, that's a good one. Of all the presidents that I worked under, I actually had the But this is because I had the closest relationship with George H.W. Bush, Bush 43. And that's because I was chairman of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee of Appropriations, providing all the funding just at the time 9/11 came along. And then following the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq and all the efforts we were making to try to rebuild the economies in those two places and build democracy there. So I ended up spending a lot of time down at the White House, and in the White House, in various meetings with the president and cabinet and other officials, trying to iron out what programs we were going to do. So he and I became good friends, and I traveled with him a couple of times. He came out to Arizona, and we just got to know each other. But I had a very good relationship with President Clinton. Worked very hard with him on NAFTA, the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, to get that enacted in the law. And before that, with President Bush, Bush 41. And I was very early in my career. I only served 4 years, my first 4 years with President Reagan. But the few times that I had a chance to be with him, I certainly liked President Reagan very much as well. I only had a chance to get to know President Obama after I was out of Congress. I did meet him, of course, while he was a senator when I was still in Congress. And he came over and asked for my advice about what we should be doing in development assistance and foreign affairs. And I really appreciated that. When he was president, I had a very minor amount of contact with him. So those are the presidents that I've known. But I go back even further than that, because when I was, of course, as a high school student, I came to Washington, D.C. as a page in the U.S. Senate for Barry Goldwater. And so my high school diploma was presented by President Dwight Eisenhower. So that really takes me back away.
Oh, my gosh. That's awesome.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, I served as a page sitting on the floor of the Senate when Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader of the Senate and Senator Kennedy was serving in the Senate. So I got to watch both of them, and particularly the interactions between the two of them, which was quite fascinating to see. Looking back on it, it was quite fascinating.
So, President Kennedy, did you have an opportunity to meet him?
Oh, yes, of course. Person? I met him. I met him in person because I was there on the floor every day of the Senate. He was, by the time I got there and was serving as a page, he was ramping up his run for president. So he wasn't around that much. But when he was there, sure, I met him, had a chance to shake his hand, talk to him a little bit, and watch him talking with others and speaking on the floor of the Senate. So I did get to know him a little bit, but I can't say I was close to him at all.
What does a page do, so our listeners understand what a page is?
It's a great program. It still exists in the Senate. I'm they have terminated the program in the House of Representatives. We're trying very hard to get it back. But it's been there in the Congress since, 200 years, more than 200 years since the Constitution was written and the first Congress was formed. The idea is young people that come there and serve as messengers. In later years, where there were other means of delivering messages, it became more of a kind of a program for young people to have an opportunity to learn about what was going on in Congress and in the government. And you build up this tremendous network, if you will, of alumni. I think there's some 16,000 now, former pages that are still alive, who go out back into their communities and say, hey, you know what they're doing back there in Washington is maybe not all that bad, and they're trying hard. They may not be doing everything right, but they try hard there. So I think it becomes a great program for young people to get a better appreciation for government. But it was a great experience, and the program has changed dramatically over the years in different ways. It's much shorter. It's much more supervised than it was when I was there. I basically came as a 16-year-old and was on my own. And we had a school, but that was it. We had to find our own place to live and show up for work. And it was quite an experience as a young person to be out on your own at that age in Washington, D.C.
You say they had a school. Was it a high school? You continued?
It was a high school.
Okay.
It was a high school. In those days, it was, as I said, you could, the PAGE program was freshman through senior year.
Oh, okay.
Today, what's left of it is in the Senate is just one semester of the junior year of high school. But they still have a school there where the students take their classes there. And yes, we had a school. We went to school every morning from 6 in the morning till 10 o'clock. And then we went to work at 10 a.m. to be on the floor of the Senate or the House, whichever we were, the House page or Senate page. And we even had Supreme Court pages in those days. They've been abolished or terminated long ago.
Why do you think they cut the program?
Well, that's a long story, but it goes back to 1990 or 2006, and to there had been the Foley scandal in 2006 when the information was that he had some involvement with pages. But and even before that, going back 10 years before that, there were two other members of Congress that did have. I mean, they admitted it and they were censured for it, but it was a different world in those days. By 2006, it caused a real ruckus, and it was also just kind of came about just before the election, and the sense was that the Republicans were going to lose the majority, and so it was being used as a battering ram. So after that happened, after that election occurred, and sure enough, the Democrats won the majority in the House of Representatives, then Speaker Pelosi decided, well, this program is a danger to me politically. So she decided to get rid of it and worked with the Republican leader on the Republican side to terminate the program. I think it was a terrible mistake, but it was done without consultation with anybody else. Just the two of them decided on their own to do that.
Yeah, that is a mistake because there are so few opportunities that help our young people to really,
absolutely,
you know, get experience and be mentored.
A great program, and, you know, one of the things that I remember very vividly about it was so many of the pages in the days that I was there as a high school student, the Democrats in the South were, of course, the senators and representatives from the South were all Democrats, and they were usually because they were not competitive seats, they served a long time. So they got a lot of the page appointments. And so you have these young pages coming up from Alabama and Mississippi and suddenly being put into Washington, D.C., and into a school where there were African-American for the pages from the House or from the Supreme Court. And it was the first experience any of them had ever had of going to school with an African-American. And it was really an eye-opening experience for them. And today, even my class, we were very close, and my class still has our reunions, and we're all as close as can be. Those pages that came from Mississippi are there to hug the Supreme Court page from Maryland, who is African American, and it's just it changed, I think, a lot of lives. It really did.
Now I can see where that would change lives, and to be taught. And this is something when I first read the title National Institute of Civil Discourse, I was thinking all politicians should go to that Institute of Civil Discourse to learn how to behave. That's why in my email I asked you if anybody's flunked out lately.
No, nobody has flunked out. We don't have that kind of a program, but we try to have programs where we can encourage people to have that conversation that we've been talking about. So that's really the purpose of the whole thing.
So it's a volunteer thing. It's not going to work. We need to make them go.
You don't enroll in a program. we have events. We have programs. We have meetings. We have sessions. And people can come or not as they choose. And we try to reach out to not only members of Congress, but also to the staffs as well, with staff in Congress and staff in government, in the executive branch. We're trying to do that as well, too.
Well, I think it's smart. I know when my son was getting ready to travel internationally, I bought him a book that said, you know, here's what you do in these different countries, because the last thing you want to do is go insult somebody unintentionally
exactly.
on their turf. So, you know, what we do here.
Did he say it helped him? Was it good?
Oh, absolutely. He's literally traveled around the globe.
Oh, that's great.
You know, there's things that you can do here that you can't do there, and you need to be respectful of it.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the great experiences I had in college. In those days, it wasn't traveling abroad was not done that much, but I was able to enroll in a program of traveling abroad and spent a year actually traveling around the world with 15 students and four faculty members. We lived with families in each of the countries we went to, and it was really an eye-opening experience for me. That was definitely one of those life, along with the PAGE program, one of those life-changing experiences for me.
I think more people, and especially our youth today, these gang members that are, you know, graffiti all over the walls and everything, I just think they should have more global view of the world, because we're not the only ones here.
Yeah, you know, we wish that everybody could have that. It's obviously not possible for a lot of people to be able to afford it, for the families to be able to make that possible. And there are many that grow up with not that kind of a point of view where they can see beyond, much beyond the community they live in. But to the extent it's possible to do that, I think it's excellent. I always have encouraged every student that I've mentored and given advice to along the way, encouraged them to do a year abroad, a study abroad program, because I think it's extremely valuable for them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you don't have the resources to do the physical traveling, I wasn't there, but he dropped out of high school and joined the Marine Corps during World War II.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So he didn't have a high school diploma. And I remember when we were in high school, he was determined to get his diploma before we did. So we helped him study for his GED.
That's great. That's terrific.
But the thing that my dad did that really, really impressed me, he wasn't, you know, he traveled during the Marine Corps, but he wasn't a vacation type person to go traveling because we didn't have the money. But he had bought a set of encyclopedias, and he read them cover to cover.
To cover. Gosh, that brings back memories. I can remember ordering our set of Encyclopedia Britannicas when I was a kid.
Exactly.
Now, of course, everything's online. You don't need those anymore. Everything's online. You just Google it. It's right there.
But, you know, it was his conversations, and he would read passages from the encyclopedias to us and say, you know, this is what they do in this country, or this is what they do in that country. So it was like,
that's
wonderful. We're not the only ones here.
Yeah, so true. And that's That's so good. I mean, so there are ways. What you're pointing out is there are ways, even if you can't do that physical travel, there are ways of compensating for that and getting those kinds of experiences. So that's
absolutely
really wonderful that he did that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute. Okay, thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are former Congressman Jim Colby. I want to ask you a question that actually started a row in the studio here a couple of weeks ago. Some people feel the Electoral College has outlived its usefulness. What is your perspective on this?
Well, sure. I guess maybe I'm a bit of a, some would say I'm a dinosaur. I don't believe that's true. I mean, I think the Founding Fathers created the Electoral College for a reason, and that is parts of it have outlived their usefulness. It's not necessary, but it was created. The idea was we couldn't know. There was no mass media. We couldn't know who really were the best candidates. So we elected people that were local that we knew, and they would go to Washington, the state, actually, to cast their ballots for whoever they thought was the best candidate to be president. That was the idea. But the numbers idea, I think, still works today. That is that the electoral votes are based on two for every state, based on the fact of the Senate, that there's two senators for every state, and then the rest of them are on the based on the number of representatives they have. So it's a combination of the states and population. And that, of course, is exactly what our Founding Fathers had in mind. That was the great compromise of the Constitution, was to balance all the rights of population against the rights of individual states, of smaller states. And I think it works in that sense. Now, you could abolish the need for individual people to go to the Capitol in Phoenix and cast their ballot for, say, in this next election for Donald Trump or for presumably Joe Biden. You could eliminate that and just have it automatic. Whoever carries the state carries those electoral votes. One other thing that I would favor, which would, I think, make states more competitive than they are now, is if you divided those electoral votes up on the basis of whoever carries the state wins those two electoral votes that are based on the Senate. And then each congressional district goes to whoever carries that congressional district. That would mean that you would have competition in a state like California. Right now, a Republican isn't going to bother going to California to campaign because there's no way that that state is going to go Republican. But if the electoral votes in San Diego or in the Central Valley could go Republican, or in parts of Orange County and in the LA area could go Republican, they would campaign in those parts and areas in order to win those electoral votes that are assigned to each of the congressional districts. And that's kind of what you've been seeing in these primaries that the Democrats have been doing, where it's based on the number of delegates are based partly on the statewide who wins the state and partly on who wins the congressional districts. So I think that's one change that could be made, and that would not require a constitutional change. I think talking about abolishing the electoral colleges is useless conversation, because it would require a constitutional change. And for sure, states like Wyoming or Delaware, or North Dakota, where they have three electoral votes, two for the senators and one representative, that proportionally gives them a larger measure than California, which is exactly what the Founding Fathers intended. They're not going to vote to make that, to abolish it. So you would not get a constitutional amendment. So I think we ought to think about things we can do that don't require a constitutional amendment change. By the way, that idea of electoral votes being assigned based on the congressional districts is done in both Nebraska and in Maine right now. So they do that.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. Chris, what's on your mind?
Well, first, I'd like to thank the gentleman for his support of the Electoral College. And I wanted to get your take on the FISA court and what's been going on recently, and just your viewpoint on it, and if you think it should be renewed. And I'll get your response off the air. And thank you. You're having a great show today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not an expert on the FISA court, but I think I certainly was one of those that helped to create it at the time of 9/11, we created that. I think it clearly needs, if it's going to be renewed, it clearly needs to be changed and modified. I think it's overstepped its bounds And I think it's far too easy for there to be warrants and warrants to go in and monitor the conversations of people. I think that individual rights need to be given a greater look of protection if we're going to renew the FISA court. It really needs to be. It's been used not just for terrorism, which was the original idea that we had there. It's been used much more broadly than that, and I think it needs to be narrowed down and made very specific terrorism issues.
For those who don't understand what that means, explain to us what that court is.
The FISA court is, let me see if I remember, I should remember the initials and what it stands for, but it's a special court that allows you to go where the prosecutors to go and get a subpoena to, they want to listen to my phone and all the phone conversations I'm having because they think I'm a terrorist. That they may not think there may not be a specific crime, which you normally would have to have in order to tap somebody's phone, but they can get that through that and monitoring conversations, following them, monitoring their mail, whatever it might be. Yeah.
Okay, so I was unaware of that it was still around.
I know the IA's intelligence, federal intelligence, our caller will tell me the exact name. Now, I used to know that, but I've been so many years since I've dealt with the FISA issue that I haven't really thought that much about it for a while.
And actually, is it really used that much now?
It is. I'm not an expert on how much, but I mean, right. Those who are civil libertarians would tell you that it's being overused for things that really are not related to terrorism. That it's got, it's been
broadened.
Expanded, they've been broadened, and they're using it as a way of going after people in other things that really do not relate to terror.
Okay, we have another caller. Ingrid, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Now that you're bringing up terrorism and the law and so forth, I feel it's a proper place for me to make a couple of comments. You talked earlier about the National Institute for Civil Discourse, run here previously by Carolyn Lukensmeyer. I'm the treasurer of the Pima Association of Taxpayers, and that office and the whole institution of that entity came to my attention, and I did some research on it, very legitimate expenses and what the purpose of it is. I'm also a libertarian, so I watch out for our rights and so forth. I'm a former vice chair of the local Pima County Libertarian Party. And in the process of doing that, I found out some very disturbing things, especially about the money. I mean, in 2016, Ms. Lukensmeyer was making $250,000, and that was the salary, who knows what else. Plus, that office cost a fortune to redo. She created a kind of fortress around herself there, and I'll let that part go for the time being. You can research it on your own. One day I got a call from a campus law enforcement officer, and I was very surprised. And I thought, well, gee, why is he calling me? Did I leave some papers there at a lecture, perhaps, and they wanted to get them back to me? No, it was Ms. Lukensmeyer who sicked him on me. So forgive that expression, but that's what it felt like. She didn't like being her activities there being looked at, perhaps scrutinized. She didn't like that. That this is what she did. And when I told him what I was doing, calling up, asking some questions or whatever, he laughed at her, not at me. This is the civil discourse. It costs a fortune. The staff there, the money involved, as treasurer of something or other, you can imagine what kind of figures I have in front of me. You're still in Washington, D.C. It would be interesting to know, you're in Arizona, I suppose. Why are you in Washington, D.C.? How come you're not back home? What are you doing there? I'll listen to what you have to say. I'll hang up now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ingrid.
Well, you've asked two very different things there. Let me deal with the latter first, why I'm in Washington, D.C. When I left Congress, I continued to have my home in Arizona. I continue to go back there as often as possible. I try to get back every 6 weeks or so and spend a week or 10 days at a time there. But I do some consulting here. I work with a think tank, the German Marshall Fund, on international, on transatlantic affairs, and do some work with a bunch of boards. I'm on the board of Freedom House. I'm on the board of the International Republican Institute, which promotes democracy around the world. So I have reasons to spend some time here, as well as my partner, my husband, who is a teacher here. So he's here in Washington in this area here. Regarding the National Institute of Civil Discourse, I can't comment exactly on that. I'm on the board of advisors. I don't adopt their budget every year, so I can't really comment on that. I think it's a pretty lean operation. I know the little office back here is quite small, quite tiny, and Carolyn is still involved in it out in Arizona and back here, but she is not the executive director at this point. So I don't know what the circumstances were that you had a call from the police department. I really can't comment on any of that, but I still believe that the concept of it and what it's trying to do is a good one. So I have been supportive of it.
Well, I appreciate your response to that. I want to ask you about some of the different programs that they have. I just went through the your website, and they have the Golden Rule 2020. What is the concept behind that?
We really need to get somebody from the organization on to describe these more explicitly and more directly, these programs. But I think that one has to do with the idea of, listening to treating others as you would want them to be treated,
right,
as you would want to be treated yourself. I think that's the whole concept of it. When you have an interaction with somebody, treat them with the same respect you would expect to be treated with. Give them the same courtesy of listening to them as you would expect to be listened to. Give them the benefit of the doubt of things they say as you would expect to be given the benefit of the doubt. I think it's really just that. It's the Golden Rule, and trying to promote that, not just in the political realm, but in our schools. A lot of this really has to go back. These values don't just pop up at the time somebody's an adult and involved in politics. It really has to go back to the time that we form those values, and that's in our families and our schools when we're much younger.
I know that today families aren't the same as when I was growing up. We'd sit at the dinner table and we'd talk about what happened during the day and who
Absolutely.
Did what to who and how can we do it differently next time. Or, it was just different. And well, today, everything's on the go.
Yeah, sure. You and I are from a different era.
Exactly.
I grew up the same way. I grew up on a ranch in southern Arizona, a cattle ranch. And when I was a child, we didn't have television. There was no television out there signal out there until I was, by the time I was in high school, we had television signal. But until then, we didn't. So we sat around at night at the dinner table and had long conversations, sometimes very heated and very, very loud. We were all arguing with each other, but arguing in a pleasant way about it. But we had our differences on whatever the issue of the day was, whether it was politics or what was happening at school or what was happening in the community. And I think that kind of conversation is what's missing today. We just don't get that conversation around the family, with the family and with others.
No, we sure don't. Okay, we're going to take our last break, and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is former Congressman Jim Colby, and we've been talking about the National Institute of Civil Discourse. And I want to address, one of the programs is called Common Sense America. I'm beginning to think that common sense today doesn't mean what it meant when you and I were kids.
Yeah, I'm not sure what common sense means today, but I think for us, what we think common sense should mean is just that. I mean, take things that are logical and make sense, that are not so far out, but just think about them, and does this really make any sense at all? And I think that's what common sense is about, using your common sense to in your everyday dialogue with people in your everyday life and the way you do things. So I think that's really what we're talking about when we say common sense. So, yeah, but I think you're right. I don't think today it's quite the same as what it was years ago.
And I think, you know, there was another program. It's called Divided We Fall. And it's so true. I mean, look at what we're doing. We're tearing apart the country because we're not willing to compromise and work together to find a credible solution to things.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, compromise is, so a lot of people think of compromise as a dirty word, but it's not. It's what we do every day. If you stop and think about it in your family life, in your workplace, you make compromises every day.
Absolutely.
Who's going to make the coffee? Who's not going to? Who's going to get up and drive the kids to school? Who's not? Who's going to do the chores around the house? We make these compromises all the time, every day, on things. And that's what we have to do in our public life as well. We have to understand that my way is not necessarily, maybe I think it's the right way, but there are other points of view. And so you try to find a compromise that can work for both of you, for both sides. And I think that's what we really need to have, is an understanding of compromise. I think the American people expect members, people who are elected to office, whether it's the city council, whether it's the state legislature, whether it's the U.S. Congress, they think they should be working together to find solutions to problems, not just shouting from the rooftops about what they think the answer is and not willing to sit down and try and find the answers with others.
If you were going to talk to a young person today who is thinking about the political arena, what would you advise them? How would you advise them to start and what to do?
Well, I actually do a lot of that right now. That's one of the things I think I do and hopefully do well, is mentoring young people. So whether it's the interns at the various organizations I'm involved with back here in Washington or out in Arizona, I try to do a lot of that. My advice to somebody that's interested, first of all, I would say, God bless you. I think it's great. We need young people who are interested and not turned off by this and willing to make a try of making a change with things.
True.
And your ideas may be a little different than I might have of what you want, the policies you want to institute, but more credit to you for going after this and doing this. My advice is just get involved. Get involved as a young person, whether it's involved in your school politics or in the community. Doesn't have to be anything that's political. Get involved in the community, volunteering, whether you're a big brother or a big sister. Get involved in the scouting program. Get involved with the community food bank. Volunteer. Just get involved. And I think you learn so much from being around other people who are involved in the same way with you. It can be very valuable. And then from that, I think you gain an appreciation for what our country is like and what our society is like and what we want to see happen there. And then I think it makes you a better person when it comes time to sit down with somebody and try to figure out what is the answer to this. You've heard different points of view. You've experienced it. You've been out there. You haven't been just sitting in your own little cocoon
bubble
there, but your own little bubble. So I think it makes it easier for you to get out there and to make these kinds of compromises and decisions.
I think people realize, or students think, that politics is all in Washington, when actually it starts from the ground up. It starts right in your neighborhood.
Right in your neighborhood. It starts with the Neighborhood Watch program. It starts with your neighborhood community program. If you have a community pool, for example, how you're going to pay dues for that, what they're going to do, what they're going to cover. It's all these kinds of things. It's politics is nothing more than interaction of individuals. And you could say you could even have politics in the home, like we were talking about a minute ago, about compromises that individuals make. That's kind of, in a sense, lowercase p, political kinds of decisions that we make about things. It doesn't have to be about the grand things about national security or education or healthcare. It can be about very simple little things. So politics is a part of our life, whether we like it or not. It's part of our life every single day. I think that what we need to understand that and just translate that up to the next level and say, hey, the compromises I'm making here at home, also I need to be thinking about making, listening to other people in my community at the national level, at the state level.
And Law Matters offers an internship as well. So if somebody's That's interested, great. You know, we do, and it's signed off on by the U of A, we do offer an internship. And it's a way That's of great. Getting involved. You need to be involved. You can't sit home and just, you know, drink your beer on your sofa and complain. You need to be involved.
You need to get involved. I agree.
Be the change that you want it to be.
Right. But when you're trying to get out there and make that change, remember that there are other people that may have a slightly different way of wanting to change it. So listen to them as well.
Yes, that's true. We don't have people fighting in the corners, you know, because they disagree
exactly.
about something that makes no
exactly.
sense. So, okay, we talked about, I think it's admirable that they have this National Institute of Civil Discourse. I just think it should be something that is required of politicians today. I think we would have a better understanding of each other if people learned how to interact with each other.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I think it's so true. And I mentioned that there are other programs that are underway back here, like Issue One, which is a program of former members of Congress working with and the reformers, reformers. So the former members trying to reform the process in Congress. There's a lot of things in the congressional process that's broken down. That's very simple things that we could fix that could bring about better discourse and more compromise. Right now, it's become very divided, and there's very little room for compromise in the way the procedures have developed over the years. And I think that's one of the things we're looking at trying to change, so that we can get more decision making and more involvement of members of Congress in the making those decisions.
And it's better for everybody if they would at least sit down and have that conversation
Absolutely.
Instead of, you know, getting on TV and acting a fool.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Do you see yourself acting like that on TV?
So I hope I didn't act that way. I try not to, but I hope I don't.
You know, and I miss that type of dignity and respect for other people. And that's, you know, when I was watching the trial. How did you feel about the trial, by the way?
The impeachment?
Right.
Well, I thought it was a mistake on the part of the Democrats to do it, because we knew from the beginning that it wasn't going to result in a conviction in the Senate, so he wasn't going to be removed. And so all you did was give him the opportunity to say, see, I've been vindicated by this. And it just helped divide the country more. It's close enough to the election. If this were a second term, maybe it's a different matter, but we have an election coming up and the American people can make that decision. So I think they should make it. Do I think his behavior was reprehensible? Yes, I do. I think his behavior has been reprehensible. And the things he's done has been pretty outrageous for the most part, but mostly for me, it's a matter of his character. The fact that he just, the narcissistic person that he is, the fact that he cannot really tell the truth, even when it's to his advantage to tell the truth. He just can't do it.
Can't bring himself to do it.
He can't bring himself to do it. So I think that's more a matter of character, and that's not necessarily an impeachable offense there. So I don't know. It's behind us. I thought it was conducted. It was sad for me to see that it was so completely polarized. You didn't have that in the case I was involved, of course, in the Clinton impeachment. And while it was fairly partisan, there were a number of Democrats that voted for impeachment, for a conviction in the Senate. And in the House, there were a number of Republicans like myself that voted against certain of the articles of impeachment because I didn't think they were well-founded. So I just think that it's just become so much more partisan today than it was then.
Yeah, and I've been telling people, stop drinking the Kool-Aid, think for yourself. You know, it always amazes me when I hear somebody say, on election day, well, whoever was the Democrat or whoever was the Republican, and they can't even name the person, but they voted for him. I was like, they could put any loose screw in office, and you're going to vote for him just because they have that label? Hello?
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't work that way, at least not where I come from.
Where we both come from. But like I said, we were both from probably a little different era, though you're much younger than I am.
I don't think so.
still from a little bit of a different era. Right.
I really appreciate you getting up early and being on the show and, you know, giving me a sense of calm.
It's quite that early back here in Washington. So
oh, that's right. That's right.
It's quite a bit later. In fact, it's just about noontime now here.
Oh, it's almost time for lunch.
Almost time for lunch here. Yes, right. So it's been a great pleasure being on the show with you. I've enjoyed it talking with you.
And when you're in town, let's do this in person after the cooties go away.
Okay.
We don't want any cooties, okay?
Okay, we'll play on that. All right.
Okay, I appreciate you being there, and I really am not surprised that you're with the National Institute of Civil Discourse.
It's a good organization. I'm very pleased to be involved, even just from a peripheral standpoint of the Board of Advisors, but I think it does good work. It's needed, whether it's that or the other organizations that I mentioned that are proliferating, where people are recognizing that we really need to have a conversation, or we need to have a different way of approaching issues today. I think that there is a recognition among a lot of people that we've got to change things.
Absolutely. And you're there doing it. I'm so proud of you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I'm proud of you and what you do there. So that's great.
Okay. And I want to remind everybody that we are doing a GoFundMe effort to help the Tucson Police Department get some very, very needed equipment. The funds that were earmarked for that equipment was used to help a dog who was bitten by somebody who was arrested get better. So we need you to go to lawmatters1030.org. In the left corner, hit the logo for Law Matters, and it'll take you to the GoFundMe page. And we need everybody. And tell all your friends and tell them to tell all their friends so we can get this equipment for our police department. Until next week, I want everybody to shop local, stay safe. And thank you, Congressman, again for coming on.